Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about cooking for Thanksgiving to start the show today with our two favorite Wisconsin chefs. One of them, Luke Zahm, in the studio with us, James Beard-nominated chef, owner of the Driftless Cafe in Viroqua, and Luke's, of course, his host of Wisconsin Foodie on PBS. Luke, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having us, Larry. This is always a treat.
Well, it's a treat for me, and I know it's a treat for our listeners. Patrick O'Halloran is our other chef. He is a Madison-based chef. His ventures have included Lombardino's and the Tipsy Cow Tavern. He's now executive chef at the Deliciouser. It's a spice blending business, so it works on that, and there's a restaurant along with it as well. Patrick, thank you for joining us.
It's always a pleasure, and I love being here with you, Larry, and of course you, Luke.
Oh, so. Man.
We're going to have some fun today, and as we talk with our two chefs, I hope you'll join in. What's your favorite Thanksgiving recipe, or which foods are you looking forward to eating? Or maybe you could tell us about your biggest cooking win or maybe your biggest mishap. I might ask these guys about mishaps.
I've got plenty.
They've had plenty of wins, but there's probably been a mishap or two along the way. Anyway, you can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Well, Thanksgiving's one of those holidays where the food is kind of the really big deal. How much do you like the traditional food served at Thanksgiving? Patrick, start with you.
Well, my family, we're a blended family,
yeah,
and we've gone into the spice blending business, and we oftentimes deviate from tradition. So, mm-hmm. For instance, the last Thanksgiving turkey we made, we cooked it in a wood-fired oven, but we made it in the style of the Yucatan, like a conchinita pibil, which has a little bit of fiery habanero pepper in it, some pickled red onions, and we served it with tortillas, so... That's one direction you can go, and we like to cook globally, but we like to also think locally, so we're always sourcing as many local ingredients as we can. Order those organic local turkeys now while you have time.
Yeah.
But, you know, we cook them in an exciting way, in my opinion. We also are known for doing a spaghetti carbonara on Christmas. It's just not traditional, but it's our tradition, so...
All right. Well, Luke, what about you?
Oh, man. Thanksgiving. You know, I'm not one. Like, I like a turkey. I'll eat a turkey if it's what we're doing. And I understand that for some people, like that tradition, it's more about that. Most of the time, if we're going to do a turkey, we'll either wood fire it or deep fry it because, you know, it's Wisconsin.
Yeah.
If we can't deep fry it, what are we even doing here? But as a chef, I really enjoy the sides, you know, and I find that when we go to family holidays and events, it doesn't matter what everyone brings, but I always feel a certain amount of pressure. Like the folks who take their home cooking seriously are always trying to get the one up on the professional chef. So if the dish that's passed is not one that's talked about a lot, I mean, I don't want to pretend like I have this gigantic ego, but I like it to be my dish, Larry.
Yeah. There's a target on your back.
Exactly. I feel like I'm already marked for failure when I walk in. So, you know, I try and think outside the box. Sometimes I do some funky stuff. Usually my brother-in-law on Thanksgiving, you know, he's a deer hunter. Mm-hmm. He's a professor here at the university. So we'll eat and then, of course, process a lot of his venison, which I think is a little bit of a double entendre there. Like he invites us all over and then we end up putting away his winter's worth of venison.
And then you're processing a lot of things.
Yeah, exactly. Just clear off that Thanksgiving table for a couple more hours and we'll get this done. But, you know, I like the sides. I really like putting a little bit of a challenge in it for myself. Like, what is it that I can make? A couple years ago, I got real creative, and I thought, you know, I could do a side. And my MO for this side is I was going to source it all from a convenience store.
Nice.
So I ended up doing a bread pudding made out of Quick Trip glazers. And, you know, kind of ran around the convenience store just like trying to find ingredients that I could pull in because it's a sport at that point. You know,
I always say you can be more creative when you put yourself in a box.
Yeah.
But I never thought Quick Trip would be that box. But it's very Wisconsin.
It is. You know, would it be the Midwest if we didn't have some sort of representation there?
One of the sides I made, I worked for the chef Scott Shelley in Milwaukee, who owns Shelley's Catering, and he took a trip out to the Napa Valley and ate at this really great French bistro that I later went to as well. And he brought back this dish of green beans that were cooked. You know, everyone does the green bean casserole.
Yeah.
His green beans, we took smoked pork shanks and we simmered them with shallots and garlic. And then we tossed it with some fresh goat cheese and it made this beautiful salad with some bitter frise. I brought that to Thanksgiving, put it out, and then I could see my cousin spitting it out into a napkin. This was some years ago, before anyone really knew about goat cheese. And my dad took me aside and put a hand on my shoulder, and he's like, we all know that you're into this cooking thing, but, you know, just tone it down a little for these family outings.
Tim in Madison actually has a question about green bean casserole. Let's go there. Tim, hi.
Yes, I don't even know if I should ask this question after that comment now, but I'm always the person that's delegated in our family to bring the green bean casserole in, and generally everyone likes it just using that traditional recipe. One of my niece who comes over from UW-Eau Claire, she always looks forward to it, but, you know, other than, you know, goat cheese or something, I'm just looking for some way to maybe spice that up and add some variety to it, since year in and year out I've been the one to have to bring that that casserole.
Timmy Green Beans has got a question on how to spice it up.
I'm trying to think, do we go kind of swing this gourmet or do we stick to like the Quick Trip aisles?
I think it's got to be a hot blend of both.
Yeah.
What would you recommend?
I mean, we do a lot, you know, traditionally the fried onions on top of the Campbell's cream of mushroom soup. So we have a spice blend that we make called Vadovan, which is a French-inspired curry from India. There was a small part of India that was colonized by the French. Most people don't know. And what did the French do? They sent chefs there.
Right.
And so the chefs took these local masalas and turned them into Vadovan, which is softened with a lot of fried onions, garlic, and shallot. So that would give it like a little bit of a twist, but it would still stay in that lane with all the onion flavor, the sweetness that you want to bring. That's where I would go, and stay away from the goat cheese unless your family's ready for it.
You know? I think that's solid and sage-like advice. I've done, in my family, we have a gentleman who is responsible for the green bean casserole every year. His name is Bobby G. Green Beans, and we've watched him over the years, you know, really kind of perfect at least the idea of the green bean casserole. A few years later, I decided that I was going to take that win on, and I found that a little bit of truffle salt, you know, in using that, you're really building up that umami. And for Tim, you know, those jerky onions on top, those fried onion chunks, those are great, but there's a really, really lovely way to be able to do that yourself, which is soak shallots or red onions or whatever you happen to have on hand in buttermilk. Let those sit in there for a little bit. And what I would suggest you do is in a small pot on the stove, heat up some oil. You want it to be fairly stable. So, you know, perhaps a seed oil or avocado oil or, you know, worst case scenario, you're going to use olive oil. Just note that it has a lower smoke point. And then fry your own shallots. And that really does make a world of difference. Not to take anything away from the good people at Durkee, you know, if you're really looking to personalize this, that's the area where people, obviously, you notice it first. You're going to probably taste that first, and it gives you a very unique spin on something that is an absolute classic.
What do you think, Tim?
Yeah, I think it sounds great. I think I might venture into the frying my own onions or shallots. So that would I'd be the highlight of Thanksgiving for sure.
Well, exactly.
And if you have the pot going and you have the fryer oil hot, also drop some Brussels sprout leaves in there.
Ooh.
Crisp those up, maybe a little good applewood smoked bacon from Wisconsin, a little hit of sherry or balsamic vinegar. That's a great side to go with that, or even replace it, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
And even the onions, as I was thinking about it, I thought, I've learned that the longer that you get those onions going, cooking, the longer the better it tastes.
Yeah.
I mean, you want to go past what you think is the end of...
Go low and slow. You caramelize all those sugars that are inside of the onion. Bring out the sweetness. And I'm surprised you do that, because last time we were here, you were talking about grating your own cheese. And I thought that was the extent of your cooking, Larry.
Yeah, exactly. The culinary prowess of Larry Mueller. I grate the cheese. Now he's going slow.
Caramelizing
onions. Maybe we
inspired
him. Yeah. Maybe we did it.
I have actually cooked. I did a well game dinner for 120 people, and I prepared 14 main course.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
Impressive.
Yeah,
what
and I've
make?
Actually taught some cooking. Oh, well, pheasant, venison, grouse, and the venison was cooked a few different ways.
Yeah.
Goose, wild goose. And it was something that took a lot of time to do.
Well, and it takes a lot of finesse with those wild game meats, too.
Yeah.
Sometimes tend to be on the drier side, so you really got to know your way around the kitchen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the cooking technique at that point, too, specifically with that low internal fat content, you know, it's good to add fat to it. It's good to add, you know, slow and low, which is what Patrick had said earlier. You know, that's kind of the key, I think, to really coaxing good flavor out of a lot of these dishes is slow and low.
You know, there will be people who haven't, this may be their first time preparing a Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah.
You know, for that big meal, and I've done others too, but for that big one, I had a whole minute by minute from the week, you know.
You made your own prep list like we do in the restaurant.
Yeah, I had it, you know, at Monday at 2:30, you're going to do this and get that ready to go for Saturday and so forth and so on. But and the day of, I had a long list up on the taped on the wall.
Yeah, well, welcome to our life, Larry. Yeah, I mean, I feel like my life is one long prep list.
I have a list waiting for me right after this show.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, but, you know, when you're talking about people cooking their first Thanksgiving, you know, it can feel overwhelming, a lot of pressure. I would suggest what you were just talking about. Make yourself a little prep list. Do as much in advance as you can.
Yeah.
Take that pressure off yourself. And then I always tell people, don't worry if you screw it up or it isn't exactly how you wanted it. Everyone that's there is going to have another appetite coming up in a couple hours.
Yeah.
So even if you think it's ruined, people will be, they're pretty forgiving.
Right. And, you know, this is Wisconsin Public Radio. We know all about Bob Ross's mantra, you know, happy little accidents. Sometimes that is like the, you know, the necessity of the situation, and you invent something that's a completely new tradition.
Our two guests are Patrick O'Halloran and Luke Zahm, both wonderful chefs and great talkers, too, as you're learning, as we talk about the Thanksgiving, and we can get to Christmas, too, dinner with them. You can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about cooking the, I was going to say traditional Thanksgiving dinner, but it doesn't have to be, just the Thanksgiving dinner. And our guest, Patrick O'Halloran, is executive chef and owner, part owner of the Deliciouser, spice blending business and restaurant as well. Luke Zahm, host of Wisconsin Foodie on PBS and owner of the Driftless Cafe in Viroqua. Questions or comments for these two guys, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or, excuse me, email to talk@WPR.org. Joanna in Verona called, couldn't stay with us. She says she is sick of, in very large capital letters, of cooking traditional Thanksgiving food. What can Joanna's family eat instead? Any ideas?
Ooh, that's a fun one.
Yeah. I think one of the first things I wanted to get across today was, if you want a better turkey and you want to keep that as a centerpiece, and it's not going to be that Norman Rockwell painting.
Yeah.
I say you spatchcock it, or you cut it into different pieces. And there's so many different directions you can go with flavor. I love to buttermilk brine it and then throw some different spice blends in there.
Mm.
And you can take it, you know, like I said, globally, anywhere you want to go, from Ethiopian Berbery to even Thai.
Yeah.
You can hit so many different notes. I'm sure there's great sides.
Totally.
That would accompany anything like that.
Yeah, you know, and I think my advice would be, it is always the impetus of a chef to find a way to, you know, make that interesting. If it was just cooking food every single day and there wasn't like an emotional connection to it, and you're just showing up to, you know, knock out a dish, that's okay for some folks. But, you know, I would push Joanna to like put some parameters on it, you know. Creativity is truly found when you actually limit your options. So for her, if it's like, hey, I want to source as much of this meal locally as I can, that's a huge win. You know, I love that. That's the ethos we cook with in the restaurant. And I try to bring that note and component to everywhere I cook. You know, this place is quite literally a cornucopia, keeping in the season of local foods and flavors. But then there's always, you know, the opportunity to branch out in different cultural traditions. I think that, like Patrick had said, you know, you can reinvent that wheel in an infinite amount of ways. The real win on holiday occasions like that is just having people together around the table.
Yeah.
And if it ends up being a talking point, like, hey, this year we decided to go in this direction, or, you know, we got tired of the traditional meal, so we wanted to funk it up a little bit, you know, that's a really important component, and I'm sure your guests would appreciate it as well.
I think there's always someone in the crowd that wants the traditional. They have to have grandma's Jell-O recipe,
or stuffing.
Yeah. Stuffing. But
I love stuffing.
But stuffing, again, there's so many different directions you can go with that. A pumpkin pie, it's a sweet gourd pie.
Yeah.
But it would take any kind of spice. It could go any direction. Add some coconut milk to it.
Ooh.
You know, apple pies, they can go any direction you want to go. So there's, like you were saying, the ethos of a chef, I always look at, if I'm making an apple pie, what's going to make this unique? What's going to tie this to this time, this place, these people?
Yeah.
So it's that's how we kind of approach it, right? We want each bite to be the best bite.
Yeah, exactly. If you're gonna walk around at a holiday Thanksgiving, you want people to be feeling inspired. Specifically, if you take your cooking seriously, you know, and trying to imagine all those flavors coming together for that perfect bite. That's the recipe for success right there. And by the way, did you happen to see that faraway, wistful look in Larry's eye when he mentioned stuffing?
He's a stuffing guy.
I love stuffing.
Do you like to mix it with the corn and the mashed potatoes, or do you let your food touch?
Well, I let it touch, but I mean, I like just to dig into that stuffing. And I might put some gravy on it. It depends on who made it.
Okay.
And so forth, but I just love the way my grandmother made it.
Okay, yeah. Tell us about it. What was it about grandma's stuffing?
Well, she put it in the turkey.
Yeah, sure. Of course.
Yep.
And so we had those juices from the turkey, I think, made a difference. And she used, she had apple, mm-hmm. and she had raisins, I think, ooh. In it, and there were some nuts of sort. I don't even remember what they were, but there was a little chunk crunch in there once in a while you'd bite into.
Yeah.
It was so good.
So you just kind of touched on what I think is like the hallmark of the Midwestern flavor profile. Salty, right? You get those turkey juices.
Yeah.
You get the sweet in those fruits.
Yeah.
And then you get a little bit of fat in there, right?
Yeah.
We love that salty, sweet, fat, rich combination. And, you know, anyone who's looking to cook an inspired Thanksgiving, anytime you put those three things together, you're probably going to hit it out of the ballpark.
Yeah.
Well, Kevin in La Crescent, or La Crescent, I should say, has a question for you guys. Kevin, hi.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
My question is, I'm very familiar with Baroque. We go up there often from this area, and I was wondering, you were talking about organic turkeys, and where do I get one of those? And also, I wanted to mention that where I grew up in southwest Minnesota, we didn't call it stuffing. We called it dressing.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is definitely a thing. Do you call it soda or pop, Patrick?
I call it soda. And I also call it a bubbler, not a drinking fountain.
Yeah.
I'm a Milwaukee kid.
What about you, Kevin?
It's pop and the drinking fountain.
Yeah, so I would say the first couple places that I like to find that organic turkey, number one, you know, I have access to Organic Valley. Organic Valley, you know, representing over 1,800 family farms all across the United States. You can find their turkeys online, but they also have retail stores in Cashton and Lafarge. If that's something you are feeling up to do the next time you come into Viroqua, hopefully you stop in and have a meal, and then, you know, you go to the Organic Valley retail store. The second place, there's actually a website called farmmatch.com. And it's all these independent small family farmers that kind of list what they have on there. And you can search by region on that website. And it takes you to many different businesses, many different scales of farms. But it's farmers who are really, really interested in cultivating that experience of, you know, the food is produced here. We want it to go directly to the consumer. So yeah. That would be my first.
Yeah, here in Madison and in some of the bigger metropolitan areas, we find really good grocers. We want to get out early before they sell out of those because there's limited supply. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is turkey time. And even some of the vendors we work with are sending us flyers like, order these turkeys now, they will go. Mm-hmm. And they'll list the farms they come from. And then, of course, we also have a network of great farmers here in Madison. So
yeah.
I'm always looking for something local.
Mm-hmm.
Used to live over by Olin Park, and there was a local farmer who had organic turkeys, fresh, not ever frozen, and he would park over in the boat landing area. I forget what day it was, but anyway, cars would come in. People were driving up from Chicago even to pick up their ordered well in advance live organic, well, not live.
I was going to say, that's a much different endeavor.
Fresh, not frozen. And by the way, what do you think, fresh versus frozen? Is there really that much difference, or is it?
I like fresh when I can get it.
Yeah.
But a frozen turkey is what we all grew up on, right?
Yeah.
So I'm going to be the one to maybe go on the other spectrum there. When we freeze something that is as dense as a turkey and we want to brine it, right? When you freeze, it destroys some of the cells in that bird, and it allows you to really suck up whatever flavors you're trying to impart. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I kind of prefer the frozen. I mean, if I can get my hands on a fresh one, sure, we'll do some fun stuff with that. But, you know, mm-hmm. It's what we're used to, what we're acclimated with. And, you know, I'm not buying black market turkeys out of the back of somebody's van on the Olin boat ramp, but.
Larry's got a turkey guy.
I got a guy.
Johnny in Waseca, let's go to you. Hi, Johnny.
Hi. Great show, guys. Thank you. I'm 70 years old. A retired professional line cook and patissier. So Thanksgiving dinner is one of my masterpieces when I get around to cooking it every year. And I start my meal inspired by my mother, and I make the house smell right by making a small stock with the gimlets in the neck and use that to moisten my stuffing.
Mm-hmm.
And I have changed mom's approach. She used to make a regular bread stuffing. A few years back, in the joy of cooking, I discovered a recipe for a sweet potato and sausage stuffing.
Ooh,
that sounds great.
Yeah.
And I use that gimlet stock to moisten that. And it's my all-purpose stuffing now, whether I'm roasting wild wood duck or turkey or duck or goose, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have stuffing kind of a battle in our house. My wife's family loves mushrooms, roasted mushrooms, which are great in there. But I like to go back to Luke's earlier point. I like to add the fat. So I bring in sausage.
Yeah.
Sausage, sage. I love the flavors of toasted fennel seed, rosemary, that kind of autumnal, like you're walking through a pine forest a little bit. So we always go back and forth and we debate. And then we have the vegetarian side of the family.
Yeah.
So I always lose and never get my sausage stuffing.
What?
You'd have to have two. I would have two stuffings under those circumstances for sure, because I'm with you on the fat side.
Yeah. But what the caller was really getting to the essence of is there's no part of that meal that's wasted, too.
Yeah.
You know, using those giblets, using all the, you know, maybe people in your family don't eat the wings. Make that stock.
Yeah, exactly.
It's truly one of the best ways to utilize all the proteins and the essence of that animal that, you know, sacrificed its life for you to be able to connect around a dinner table. But then the countless number of leftover recipes go, you know, up exponentially when you can take and use all the parts of that animal.
I'm wondering how you guys feel about cranberries. I use them more like craisins. I love the dried cranberry plumped up in like a little white wine or maybe a little fortified wine like a Marsala. Mm-hmm. But I sense, Luke, you like the can. When it comes out, it still looks like a can.
Is it because I'm from Lafarge? You just assume that I like canned cranberries?
You're a small town boy.
Well, I've had my fair share of canned cranberries. I don't want to lead listeners astray here. But, you know, recently, cranberries, you know, Wisconsin is the leading producer of cranberries in the entire United States, and we export a tremendous amount all over the world. I kind of take that as a pride point. I really like using fresh cranberries lately. And the way to use those is you cook them with a little bit of sugar or maple syrup or honey, whatever it is, and you cook them in water or wine until they plump up and explode.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah.
You got to do something to mitigate that tart.
Yeah, exactly. Know? And then, you know, I usually kind of treat it like a chutney. I add in a little bit of garlic. I add in a little bit of onion and then, you know, some chiles. Some dried toasted spices.
That would be awesome. Yeah.
Right? And then there's so much darn pectin in those things. Like that, it seizes up tighter than a squirrel's ear. It's
and then you just shove it into a used can and pop it out. You get
pop
the shape that you're used to.
This one's for you, Grandma.
You know, Mary emailed us with a recipe recommendation. She uses cranberries baked with sugar and amaretto.
Ooh.
It's she says delicious. Even people who don't care for cranberries like this one.
Yeah.
So,
another divisive thing I've come across is the sweet potato with the marshmallow on top.
Yep.
There's so many great things you can do with a sweet potato, and there's a savory note to them, and you can brown them. I would never put a marshmallow on it.
Yeah.
It's just not my jam, I guess.
Yeah. I'm not a huge marshmallow guy. I mean, the need to brush my teeth immediately after eating Thanksgiving dinner, you know, doesn't always sit well with me. But I know that the kids...
I've noticed that about you.
No, yeah, exactly. That guy is constantly brushing his teeth.
No, he needs to.
He needs to brush his teeth. But, you know, the kids, they get after it. And, of course, you know, happy kids are truly the anecdote for most things that, you know, get under our skin during the holiday season. So if those kids are happy, I'm happy. But, yeah, I like to do my sweet potatoes with a little bit of brown sugar. You know, basically you're making that streusel topping, brown sugar, butter, flour, and like really roast that on there so you get all those caramely bits and you let the potato shine a little bit.
Yeah.
No, I was thinking back to cranberries because I always keep a bag of fresh cranberries in the freezer.
Sure.
And then pretty often when I'm making pancakes, I'll take a handful out, smash them, throw them in the pancakes batter.
Yeah.
So cranberries instead of blueberries.
Yeah.
You got cranberries, and of course you're putting maple syrup.
Yeah, there's your sweetness.
There's your sweetness,
and it's pretty darn good.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, cranberries. Who knew?
Let's see. Myra emailed us with a few questions for both of you. What can we serve that's quick and easy for those who want to nosh on something before dinner.
Yeah.
And then there's one for you specifically, Patrick. What spice blends should we consider for Thanksgiving? Which blends bring out the traditional flavors?
Do you want me to answer the first one first, sir?
Yeah, go ahead.
Are you going to talk about cheese?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about cheese. I mean, like...
it sounds like...
Yeah,
this is a cheese situation.
This is a cheese situation. That's why I got that really, right. You know,
for
sexy.
For the before the dinner.
Yeah. That's my cheese voice. So I would say this time of year, get your hands on some of Upland's Rush Creek Reserve. Mm. It's only made this time of year, and it's a cheese made just outside of Dodgeville, between Dodgeville and Spring Green, by Andy Hatch and the folks at Upland's. And I think the best way to describe it for radio is it's kind of pudgy. It's mm-hmm. like one of those cheeses that has – it's semi-soft. My favorite way to prepare that one is I just heat the whole darn wheel up in its spruce bark at all. And then once it's heated up, if you put it in a cast iron pan, warm it in the oven – serve it with some charcuterie, serve it with some toast points, some crackers. It really doesn't matter what you serve it with. It is dynamite.
It is really good.
Yeah.
And that cranberry chutney you were talking about?
Yeah.
Maybe some nice local honey?
Oh, yeah.
You got to, you know, bring that savory sweet element. I think that would be knock it out of the park right there.
Gentle breeze honey.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Honey.
Listen to us getting all. I'm starting to get hungry in here. But, O'Hale, take us through the spices.
So as far as those traditional flavors, I mean, with our company, we have one spice blend called Super Tuscan, which has the notes I'd mentioned earlier of like juniper berries, rosemary, sage, black pepper, lemon. There's powdered honey in there. Mm. So it's the things you would think of if you were in a forest in Tuscany.
Yeah.
But every time I open that jar and sample it with people, it smells like Thanksgiving in a jar.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great with turkey. It's great with chicken. It's just great with mushrooms, potatoes, all of those flavors. And then we have another one called Antica, which was one of the first spice blends I came up with. And I named it Antica because it represents the first spices that European adventurers and spice traders went to the Far East to bring back, which are notably peppercorns, cloves. We have cinnamon in there, true Ceylon cinnamon from Sri Lanka. There's a little bit of ginger, mm-hmm. notes of toasted anise. So these are the antique spices. This is we call pumpkin spice. It's the sophisticated cousin of pumpkin spice is what I like to call it.
By the way, where do people buy these spices?
You buy these at thedeliciouser.com. We ship nationwide. But also we have our... store and our restaurant is right in downtown Madison on the Isthmus. We have this really cool building called Main Street Industries, which is owned by Commonwealth Development, a nonprofit, and it's a collective of really cool businesses. So we have one unit in there where we have a spice lab where mm-hmm. we are manufacturing, blending, toasting, mm-hmm. grinding spices. And then the next unit next door is our restaurant where we actually cook with them. So we're one of the only places I know of in the nation that's producing and cooking with their products in an open kitchen environment. So you can come in and like be part of the show and see what we do with these spice blends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought you named the Antica spice after Larry's headphones. For all the listeners at home, you should see these things.
Yeah.
They truly are a marvel.
They're vintage.
They are like 1984 Sony Walkman headphones, but he wears them with such gusto and pride.
Sennheiser made the made these headphones, and there was one point where Sennheiser announced that they were making an updated version of the headphones, and the updated version I knew wouldn't be as good as this version, which was far less money. So I asked the engineers here, this is many a year ago, I said, go and buy all of the old Sennheiser headsets that are in existence. I forget who it was, came back to me and said, I'm going to places. He said, every other radio station is doing the same thing.
Well, when something's good, you hold on to it.
So, and now I think they're at least manufacturing the little yellow softeners around your ears.
Sure.
For your ears that you can still get new ones. Anyway, back to Thanksgiving.
Sorry.
Luke's been intrigued by those headphones.
Oh, I love those headphones. I look forward to coming into the studio just to see Larry in those headphones. It's unbelievable.
They're kind of bright yellow.
Yeah.
Black, you know, black.
Yeah.
band, but yellow earmuffs, yeah, we call them. Dennis in Two Rivers, your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. One of my pet peeves is there are some products that are supposedly natural or all natural. When I go to my raspberry plants and pick a raspberry, that's all natural. But when something is put in a can or a jar or a box, I don't consider that to be natural. And I just want to let the two of you know, yesterday Larry was promoting combining bratwurst and sauerkraut. I mean, I never saw such a thing.
We're calling out Larry's culinary prowess. I love that. I love that.
I was interviewing the woman who, nutritionist who had written a history of sauerkraut.
Oh, sure.
And of course, when you get into sauerkraut, and in fact, you know, there's a company out of Florida that's moved its home offices from Florida to Madison, mm-hmm, and has purchased and is in the process of getting closer to the producers that, yeah, who are right here in, yep, Wisconsin.
Yeah, yeah, you know, so I would say, number one, if natural or organic, obviously those things, you know, anytime you can visit the farm and pull it yourself, you know, that speaks to the highest level of trust, mm-hmm, between consumers and the growers. And so much of, I guess, how I source food is based on that trust. And if it's something, obviously, that matters to you, as, you know, I believe it should, read those labels. Yeah, you know, there is an actual difference between USDA organic and naturally grown. Those are important to understand and, you know, be a conscious consumer. Because at the end of the day, you know, you vote with your dollars and use them as you see fit. But as far as this kraut and brats go, you know, like I like a kraut with brat. Do you ever cook them together? Like,
yeah, I mean, I would probably grill the bratwurst, yeah, but then I would put them into the sauerkraut.
Sure. You know,
I spent some time in Switzerland, and some chefs that I worked with came and visited Milwaukee, and I was in charge of feeding them for a few days, and so we grilled some brats. Of course, in Milwaukee tailgate style, they're a little bit burnt on the outside.
Yeah,
they go into,
sure,
into a bun with some raw onions, maybe some sauerkraut, and they were aghast at this. They had never seen anything like it, because they would do their brats, you know, pan-fried,
sure,
roasted on a pool of veal demi-glace.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe there would be potatoes and sauerkraut, but that would be on the side. So seeing us like drink that with a Pabst Blue Ribbon and smothered in stadium sauce, yeah, it was not their jam again. You know?
Oh, man. Patrick O'Halloran and Luke Zahm, our guests today. I'm Larry Mueller for WBR News. Great to have you listening in today as we talk about preparing and serving the Thanksgiving dinner with our two guests, Patrick O'Halloran, who is executive chef at the Deliciouser spice blending business and restaurant. Luke Zahm, of course, is the host of Wisconsin Foodie on PBS and is the owner of the Driftless Cafe in Viroqua. Questions, comments, and experience to share, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Joe in Chippewa Falls emailed us. Joe always looks forward to Thanksgiving Day at his wife's family house, although he knows it means a lot of work in the days before and after. Normally, they all sit down at 1 with all the regular traditional foods, and about 2 hours later, they all go back to our arranged seats for round 2, which is the dessert meal. And each time, the entire table, it would be, for the dessert meal, for example, the entire table is filled with many types of desserts. Then begins the diet, he says, after the nap, of course.
I can appreciate that.
Yeah. That just reminded me of my dad. We always have to take a walk.
Yeah.
There's always a big, long walk before we come back and eat more.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, that's a good thing to do.
Yeah. It, you know, but I can, if I think about that and I listen to this, this caller's experience, I know that feeling of discomfort on that walk. You're trying to move something around someplace. Yeah. You're not quite sure where it's at or where it's going, but something's got to happen. But that sounds like an amazing experience, you know? Sit down, do it once, get up, sit down, do it again.
It's really well orchestrated.
Yeah, very
well orchestrated.
I wonder if they have a prep list.
Yeah, they must.
If they would like a job.
I had an experience, it's probably 20 years ago now at least, I was maybe even a little further back than that. I knew a guy who had just started work, had been working for a little while in the Department of Life Sciences Communication, got married, and he and his wife invited us over for the turkey dinner. Which we went, and it was not even on Thanksgiving Day. It was kind of an earlier sort of thing, you know, a Saturday kind of thing. Anyway, the turkey didn't get done and didn't get done and didn't get done, and hours had gone by. And, well, when she finally pulled the bird out, she said, "Can you help me with this?" And I look inside, and the neck and the giblets in the frozen bag.
And that's when you keep your favorite takeout place on speed dial. Like, just give them a call. Easy peasy. Lemon squeezy.
So a bit of a mishap.
Yeah.
Have you guys had mishaps?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, we've had them.
Yeah. I've tipped it over more than once in the kitchen. You know, and yeah, I think... Man, some of my most famous mishaps. It's like the simple ingredients, the ones that are the dishes that you think are okay. So I've got the mashed potatoes down. Now I'm gonna get chefy on the gravy. Little word of advice to our listeners: don't get chefy on the gravy. I remember one year I had reduced apple cider down that we had made, and I've got this apple cider reduction, and I kicked it into the gravy, and you expect gravy to be rich and salty and packed with umami, and instead you got this really flavorful sweet sour spike, and that's when you get pulled aside by your dad, Patrick, and just turn it down about 1,000.
My dad also told me when I first started cooking, he's like, just because you have all these colors in your palette doesn't mean you need to use every one of them in every dish.
That's exactly right. You know, sometimes simple is better. Yeah. I think if my culinary experience working for you, it really taught me that sometimes very specific and mindful ingredients really truly do create the best dishes. And, it's always a chance to sift and winnow, as we like to say here at the university, but really finding out what it is that you want out of that component and drilling in on it. Mm-hmm.
Rich in Madison has something for us. Rich, hi.
Hi there. Winnow, as we like.
Oops, sorry about that. Hi there. How are you today? Thank you for taking my call.
Hope
I'm not overstepping my bounds, but our son, Zach, is a recent addition to the team in the kitchen at Deliciouser, and he is raving about the experience so far. And I'd like to ask your guests there, the chefs, if they were going to make something like off the beaten path, so to speak, for Thanksgiving, something with still a Thanksgiving feel or flavor, but something unusual, could they please recommend something? Thanks. Bye.
Okay. Off the radar side dish, kind of.
Yeah.
Off the radar side dish.
I know what I'm doing this year. So I have a freshman in college who is playing baseball over in Minnesota. And a lot of his teammates, specifically are from Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic, the Caribbean. So they're all going to come to the house for Thanksgiving. And, I really want to be inclusive. I want to, make sure that everybody feels like they get at least a touch of home. So this year we're going to do tamales. is a family. So, you know, get that masa dough. I've got some dried corn that I get from Ohelagu, which is a growing collective up in the Oneida Reservation. And this is like some beautiful, beautiful dehydrated corn. We'll make up the masa meal. And, you know, all sorts of tamales. So, you know, having ingredients and stuff to put in them and then steam them. And I think that the process of making tamales is only slightly less fun than eating tamales. Because it is. It's yeah. You're using your hands. You're thinking
and
about it.
And it's always
it.
A group activity.
Yeah,
I mean, we're going to be doing dinner with tamales, tequila and tamales for Christmas because it's such a festive holiday thing in, you know, Latin American Mexican culture.
Yep. So what do you do off the beaten path?
What do I do off the beaten path? You know, like most I said, usually it's spaghetti carbonara.
Yeah.
That's my go-to in my pajamas. As a chef, I oftentimes will cook for others, and I never want to eat that food.
Yeah.
So that's a dilemma that I always have. So I end up doing, like, Szechuan takeout. Yeah. But to our caller's point, his son Zach started with us, and we've done some really crazy dinners over the last few weeks since he's been on the team. One, we did a collaboration with a mixologist, and one of his drinks was called the Joan Jett. So our dish was called the Black Heart.
Nice.
Where we made a foie gras mousse in a little beautiful red leaf lettuce cup. Oh. And then we did brined and charcoal grilled duck hearts, and then a black ash made from garlic, shallot, and onion peels. So, like, something like that is really off the beaten path. But if you have access to duck and foie gras, that would be a great holiday dish. But, you know, there were some other weird ones. Like, we did the dessert was the drink was called the Death Flip, and our dessert was a splash of a beet and ginger sauce, like a murder scene on a plate, and then a chocolate mousse from Southern Italy that had pig's blood in it.
Ooh. Wow.
So this was a journey from the womb to the tomb.
The
first course was a taco. One of my great friends from Mexico City loved tacos de nana, pork uterus.
Oh my gosh.
True nose to tail eating every part of that pig. Yeah. And my friend, another friend of mine from Mexico City said, in Mexico City, we don't have a lot of money, a lot of the people, so we have a taco for every budget. So every part of that pig is used,
sure.
From the eyeballs to the lungs to the uterus.
Yeah.
So we tried to honor those traditions, and they just seem to fit into this dinner. So, like, Zach, the cook who's working with us, he's seen some funky stuff.
I bet.
I don't know if you can work that into Thanksgiving.
Yeah, that might be a little bit of a stretch. You know, even I over here, I'm like, okay, yeah, go, sir. You got this. You got this.
Well, what about Scott here, who called in but couldn't stay with us? Getting back to maybe something a little more traditional, but something a lot of people don't like at all, but I like Brussels sprouts. Mm. And he's wondering, he's looking for more Brussels sprout recipes.
Yeah.
Brussels sprout salads.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work, but I think you can buy them now, like the leaves pre-cut. But you do it yourself. You core them out. And you make like almost like a Caesar salad, or you can use those dried cranberries in there. And of course, like we said, the deep fried Brussels sprout is pretty darn good.
Yeah.
And if you want to go off the beaten path, make a fish sauce vinaigrette with it.
Sure. You know, the fish sauce, a little bit of sugar, a little bit of lemon juice or lime juice, some chiles in there, maybe some cilantro. Like, you know, you get really, really big umami flavor. I love Brussels multiple different ways. You know, so I like the salad. Sometimes I make that Brussels sprout slaw.
Yeah.
I don't know if we ever made that at Lombo's where, like, you slice it just thin to win. And then you toss it really simply with lemon juice and salt, which is lovely. You get all the nutrient benefits of that raw Brussels sprout, but you get that push-pull of salty and acidic and green.
And you need the acid because there's so much fat in Thanksgiving dinner.
My gosh.
You need some acidity in there.
Yeah, levity. That's what I'm always saying. Like, I want my dishes with levity. Obviously, you know, you can do the deep-fried Brussels sprouts. I like doing that. You know, if you can find a good vinegar that you're in love with, or even better, a vinegar powder. That, for me, when I was just in New York City, I bought a whole bunch of apple cider vinegar powder. So it's dehydrated vinegar.
Yeah, that's in a lot of our spice blends.
Yeah.
We have different vinegar powders.
Yeah, And all I want to do is just throw that on those Brussels sprouts after they've been fried up with a little bit of salt and black pepper.
Sounds awesome.
You are awesome.
Awesome having you guys on. Patrick O'Halloran of the Deliciouser and Luke Zahn of Wisconsin Foodie on PBS and the Driftless Cafe in Viroqua. So much fun. I'm gonna get them back one way or another.
We'll get you back, Larry.
I might even triple your appearance fee.
All right.
Their appearance fee has been zero, so I might go 10 times.
Yeah. I'll take what I can get.
Yeah, exactly.
Great to have you listening in here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. And, you know, here in Wisconsin, we are, I think, known for a wonderful collection of bakers. We bake in this state. We do a lot of baking. And the baking gets done the year round, certainly. It changes a bit over the seasons. But I think the heavy baking period is upon us. And we'll be through the next 2 months. And so it seems fitting to talk with our next guest today, Chris Kimball. Christopher Kimball has a new book out. It's called Milk Street Bakes. It is a lovely book, and it covers a whole, pretty much any area of baking you can think of, I think, is covered in this. Chris is founder of Christopher Kimball's Milk Street, a food media company dedicated to changing the way we cook. They produce a magazine, a radio, and a TV show. Chris is also the author of many books, including one I kind of like, Fanny's Last Supper. So as we talk with Chris, I hope you'll join in. Maybe let us know why you love baking, or what do you bake during this time of the year? Maybe you're struggling with a certain recipe that you'd like some help with. How can we help? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Christopher Kimball, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
Your book, which is just a lovely book. In fact, I don't have my own copy of it right now. I have Jill Nadeau's copy. And Jill Nadeau told me that I had better not lose this book. It might find it. I think she thought it might find its way into my own collection of books. But this is a real dandy. And maybe just give us your thoughts on why you put this together and how it's put together.
Well, the concept is the same as Milk Street's idea. Travel the world, cook with people, mostly home cooks, have them teach you new ways of cooking, new recipes, bring them back, put them in our kitchen, adapt them to the American home kitchen. And then, you know, you end up changing the way you cook. Now, baking is particularly apt because the way people bake around the world is very different than here. You know, most cultures do flatbreads, for example, not something we do very well here. A lot of baking in the rest of the world are things you have with a cup of coffee in the late afternoon, right?
Yeah.
Well, a lot of cultures don't actually do desserts like we do. So the kinds of things they bake are different. So for example, in Crete, there's a broken phyllo cake. So you take phyllo, rolled up, cut it into 1-inch strips, thrown in an oven for 15 minutes to dry it out, make an easy cake batter, throw the phyllo into the batter and put that into a pan and bake it. And the phyllo, there's no flour. The phyllo is the flour. And you get this amazing cake that has a sugar syrup that's soaked into it. So, you know, that's not something that I never heard about growing up in New England. So, you know, I couldn't even spell phyllo probably. So, you know, there's just so much out there that's so interesting. The, you know, invisible cake where you take four or five apples and you slice them super thin and you make this cake that has like 1,000 layers because the apples are so thinly sliced. So it's just really fun to look at baking from a other point of view.
And you cover breads of all kinds, pizza, pies and puddings, what else? Loaf cakes, small cakes.
Loaf cakes, you know, Claire Patak owns a bakery in East London. She did the royal wedding in 2017 or whatever. And one of her specialties are loaf cakes. So, you know, you make a caramel sauce, you put that at the bottom of a loaf pan, add some sliced fruit like peaches or whatever, put the cake batter on top, bake it, and then flip it upside down. And so you have this amazing, you know, fruit, you have the caramel sauce, you have the cake. And it's a one pan cake. It's not a multi-layer cake. So, you know, it's easy to do. So that's just another way of thinking about, you know, baking is it can be simpler, but it's really interesting.
Yeah. Mary in Wausau has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Such a privilege to talk to you. I've been a long time fan. I make a strata for Thanksgiving. We do brunch just so all my other kids can go to the in-laws wherever they want, and the brunch is to work out for us. And so I put a lot of extra eggs and extra filling in my strata. And how do I get the middle cooked properly without burning the edges? Just do I go lower and slower, or what would be your recommendations? And I add a lot of extra fillings like sausage, spinach, cheeses, everything.
Sounds good. What about that, Chris?
Yeah, if the center isn't getting baked before the edges, there are two things you can do. Use a light-colored pan. Darker pans will definitely conduct heat to the outside more quickly. It makes actually a pretty big difference. And the second thing is definitely lower the oven, like put it in a 325 instead of a 375 or whatever. And that should help. Yeah.
Yeah. Mary, there you go. Good luck. It sounds great to me. And thank you for calling. Kelly emailed. They literally just took the chocolate and tahini babka from the latest issue of Milk Street out of the oven. Just did it. It's Kelly's first time making this bread, and they can't wait to try it later. So the chocolate and tahini babka.
Yeah, that's a great recipe. I mean, you know, tahini is interesting because it wasn't really well known here till maybe 10 years ago. And now it's being used in lots of things. You can put it in, you know, peanut butter cookies. You can put it in brownies. You know, you can put it in lots of things. But with that recipe, it's just absolutely amazing. The thing I like about tahini is it gives you obviously a nutty, slightly savory base, which is really good when you have something sweet. You know, the problem with chocolate chip cookies, I mean, assume that anyone agrees there is a problem with chocolate chip cookies, which may be not true. But it's really nice to pair, you know, something, a little bit of savoriness. It's like, you know, many bakers today are using a little bit of rye flour with the all-purpose. Mm-hmm. So in our chocolate chip cookies, we use a lot of rye flour with all-purpose. And rye slightly bitter. And so it gives you, you know, sweet and bitter. I mean, a lot of baking and cooking is about, you know, creamy and crunchy, sweet and sour, bitter, you know, et cetera, sweet. So having the contrast is really what great baking is about, I think.
Yeah. Kelly, thanks so much for that email. You can email in too, talk@wpr.org. That's the email address, talk@wpr.org. Or you can call us 800-642-1234. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. Did you learn a lot from writing this book and putting it together? Or what did you learn?
Never do a cookbook again. I don't know.
You know, you've got over 200 recipes in it.
Well, first of all, let's be clear about who did the book. You know, we have a team of people here, 7 or 8 people in the kitchen. I travel the world. My editor, JM, travels the world. So it's really a group effort. It's not just me. But the fun part for me, I'll tell you a quick story. I was in Cuyahoga Market in Mexico City a few years ago, early in the morning. It's kind of chilly out. It was dark. And we were waiting to set up to cook with a chef who had a restaurant there. And she served this cup of coffee with this corn cake. And it was a one-layer round cake. It was something between cake and cornbread. And I never had anything like it. And actually, it's made in a blender, the batter. And it was phenomenal. It was like this entirely new experience. It's kind of like a corn-flavored red velvet cake, I guess. Not too sweet. And it's that joy of discovery when you don't expect it. You know, it wasn't a recipe I was looking for. So for me, the answer to your question is, I've learned that I don't really know very much. And that, you know, I've been doing this over 40 years. You get to the point where you think like, well, I got this down. But the fact of the matter is, that's ridiculous. There's so much out there. And the surprises are almost always pleasant. I mean, it's just like, oh, I never thought of that. Another quick example is I was in Mexico a different time, and we were cooking beans, and the chef made a sofrito, which is, you know, peppers and onion stuff cooked in a skillet. And he added it to the beans right before serving, instead of starting the recipe with a sofrito, right? And then, so he added it at the end. And I was like, well, why have I been adding it at the beginning? Because all those flavors, you know, instead of melding into everything else, they're fresh. And you could taste the garlic and the onion and the peppers and the chilies. So yeah, it's that I learned so much. And that is my takeaway from this book is, you know, I've been a baker since I was 7 or 8 years old, and I just learned so much from doing this book.
Yeah. And you, you know, many people call baking a science. What's your thought, or maybe explain the thought behind that?
Well, I'm one of those people, for better or for worse. Yeah, there's science to it, because the pH of your batter, for example, will affect what kind of leavener you use, right? Baking soda, baking powder, both. You know, sugar attracts moisture. It's hygroscopic. But if you use honey, that's going to change the nature of the dish. And that's, you know, if you use vegetable oil instead of melted butter, like you do it in carrot cake, that's going to change the texture of the cake long term. So the kind of pan you use, the size of pan you use, some things are less finicky than other things, but you don't want to go messing around. Like people often say, well, I have this cake recipe, there's too much sugar in it, the 3 cups of sugar. And I go like, okay, but I'm going to cut it in half. And I'm going like, well, no, maybe cut it 20% to start, because it changes the chemistry. So yeah, there is a lot of chemistry. I think it shouldn't, the fact that there's chemistry shouldn't scare you.
Right.
It shouldn't make you not change things, but always make the recipe the way it was written the first time. And then once you've got a handle on it, then you can start messing around with it. But obviously you can mess around with a stir fry a lot, a lot more. It doesn't matter in a stir fry what you change. But it does matter, you know, in a Genoise, the slightest change can be disastrous.
Jackie in Chippewa Falls has something for us. Let's go there. Jackie, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share my experience with pie crust. I have made a good pie crust for many, many years. My mother taught me. I kind of do it by feel, but I always use Crisco. And for a while, I didn't bake pies. I just didn't have the need for it. And I went to bake a pie, and my crust wouldn't turn out well. And I was using my Crisco and my flour and my salt and my ice butter. I couldn't get it rolled out. And it would break. It would just chunk into breaking pieces. And I thought, this is just wrong. It's not stretchy. So I threw it back in the bowl, put a wet paper towel over the top of the crust and put a lid on it, you know, good old Tupperware, and went and had a cup of coffee for about a half an hour, and I came back and took it, opened it up, and tried to roll it out, and it was absolutely perfect. Well, I called the company and asked them what had changed, and it was about the time that they had done something with whatever was unhealthy. I mean, it's all unhealthy, I guess, but they had done something with whatever was in there, and they changed it some. And so now I can make pie crust with Crisco again. And I also wanted to tell you about my accident pie. When I bake pies, when it gets fall time, I want an apple pie and I want a pumpkin pie. And so I make enough pie crust to make two crust pie and a one crust pie. So I did that, and for some reason, I don't know why, but I had extra pumpkin. I just, you know, and that little piece of pie that I roll out and put butter and cinnamon sugar on in the oven and just eat it like cookies, no, that wasn't going to happen. So I took a little pie pan, and I put that crust in there, and I had, oh, I don't think I had a cup and a half of pumpkin, but I stuck it in there, and I thought, well, that's not going to be enough in there. By the time your crust is done, your pumpkin's going to be rubber. So I had a wayward apple in there, so I peeled it and put some cinnamon in with the apple and put that in the pie and just kind of pushed it down into the pumpkin. And, okay, we'll throw that in. It comes up a little higher. It's a little more filling, so okay, we'll cook it. That was the best apple pumpkin pie. Oh, it was so good.
Chris, Jackie brings up a couple of things, one relating to Crisco and the other relating to her apple pumpkin pie.
Yeah, Crisco, I mean, making a pie with Crisco, which I've done, it's easier to roll out and it'll be flaky. Butter, of course, has more flavor, but butter is a little harder to work with. So in general... And now they have the non-hydrogenated Crisco. So, yeah, you can do that. The best thing, actually, the best thing to make a pie with is pork lard. And it's the lard from around the kidneys. And that stuff is amazing. It doesn't taste like pork at all. And one of my kids processed a couple of pigs a few months ago and made some lard for me. And so I keep that in the fridge. That's the best stuff. But butter is a little trickier. The two things people do wrong with pie crust, they don't cut the fat in enough to the flour. Recipes say pea-sized pieces. That's nonsense. Like, you really want to cut it in because then the fat is covered with flour and there's less gluten development. The second thing is people are afraid of adding too much water to their pie dough, which means it ends up being dry and it's hard to roll out. So you're better off making sure you have enough water in it. And, there isn't that much gluten development in a pie dough anyway. The other last trick I'll leave people with is you can use half vodka and half water when mixing your dough. And most of that liquid in the vodka, the alcohol will burn off. So you have the benefit of a soft, malleable dough. But when it bakes up, it actually bakes up nice and flaky. So that's another trick.
Oh, some tricks of the trade from Christopher Kimball's latest book is titled Milk Street Bakes. It's a lovely book and covers baking in many areas and from many areas of the world, as a matter of fact. Join in with your own questions or comments. The number is 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking baking on the program right now with Christopher Kimball, and his latest book is titled Milk Street Bakes. Lovely book. Questions? Give a call at 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. And let's take a call from Laura in Portage. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I have a question about sham tort. I come from a family that used to make sham tort. My mother made sham tort in a spring mold, and like an angel food cake spring mold. And then her mother-in-law made individual sham torts. And once I tried making it, and it's just like egg whites, and it was real nice in the oven. And then, you know, it rose. And the next time I opened the oven carefully to look at it, everything had fallen. It was just it's not a slimy liquid at the bottom. And before I die, I'd like to make Sham Tort.
Okay, Christopher?
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's a recipe you should make after you die because it's a killer. I mean, it's meringue. You're cooking a meringue. And I know this is an old wives' tale, but it's true. It's humidity. Like doing it in the summer, if it's humid, is just really tough. A lot of people, you do it at very low oven temperatures, even turn off the oven and let it sit in the oven for another hour or two. It has to really dry out to form that structure. So it's like pavlova. It's really a similar thing. And you can fill it with berries and whipped cream, whatever. But it don't feel bad. Because even professional bakers, if it's not a nice dry day and there's too much humidity, you're going to have a problem. But it's a lot of time in the oven, very low oven, and you really got to dry out the meringue. So, you know, it's one of those things. I guess it's a good life goal. It's as good as any other, but it ain't easy. Yeah, you're right.
When you say very low, what is very low?
Oh, you can do it at like 225 or 250, something like that. It's really, and very often recipes will say turn off the oven and then close the door and let it sit. So you really want low and slow because what you don't want to do is brown it. I mean, it should be nice and white, like, you know, a cooked meringue, but you want it to dry out. So you don't want too much heat. It also could be, it's one of those recipes where if your oven is not calibrated properly, you could have trouble as well because you need the right temperature. So that's something you should check out.
Yeah, and I know my own electric oven is, it runs about at three, when it's 350, it's really 355. It runs about.
Well, mine is, when it's 350, it's about 375. So yours is more accurate than mine.
But but even 5 degrees makes a difference.
Yeah, well, I think, look, you have to ignore every bit of timing in any recipe ever written. It's total nonsense. Like in an oven, as you said, like some ovens can be 350. If you set it 350, some ovens will be 310, some will be 390. And on stovetop, medium, it depends on how many BTUs, British thermal units, your burner puts out. So like here in the office, we have a burner that, you know, it's like I got a candle under it. It has no power. And at home, I have a much more powerful burner. So medium here versus medium home is just the, you know, so you just forget times. Those are very rough ideas.
So times you kind of have to forget. But the thing on measurements, I think you need to be more precise, and you do talk about this in your book. You need to be more precise when it comes to amounts of various things.
Well, the first thing is, if you're baking, and that's what we're doing here today, you definitely need a scale, a digital scale. I mean, you can't bake effectively without it. If a recipe calls for a cup of flour, and you have 10 people measure a cup of flour, you know, you're going to get all sorts of different, you know, if 5 ounces, 4.5 ounces, 5.5 ounces, it depends how you compress the flour into the cup. So it's much better weighing, and it depends on which chart you use, but about 130 grams per cup for all purpose. And so that's really important. Now, in some recipes, like in a pie crust recipe, it doesn't really matter that much, but in a cake of some kind, then it really does matter. So weigh your ingredients.
And when it comes to, you mentioned flours, and when it comes to flours, you know, let's say you're making some bread and, oh, I don't happen to have the bread flour, so I'm just going to use all purpose. And then it may not turn out at all like you like it. What is it? What are the differences among those flours?
You're a crazy man. You're going to use all-purpose flour instead of bread? You're just like, you're living on the edge. That's great. A fearless baker. Yeah, the difference is gluten. I mean, there are two proteins in flour, glutenin and gliadin, to get into the science. And when in contact with water, they're able, it's sort of like spaghetti, you know, they sort of can join and wrap together and connect. And that creates gluten, which allows the bread to rise. It traps the gases created by the yeast. So in a bread flour, it's higher protein, there's more gluten and gliadin, you get more gluten development as opposed to all-purpose flour. So bread flour might be 14% protein. All-purpose flour, depending on the brand you get, is 10 to 11, a little higher for King Arthur. Cake flours or soft wheats, which have less protein, which are 8 or 9% protein. So gluten is important. You can make regular bread. I mean, I kind of made fun of you, but you can make you can make bread with all-purpose flour. But you're probably not going to get the same kind of rise out of it. It's a little bit different, but you can do it.
Yeah, you don't get the same rise out of it. That's for sure.
Yeah, oh, and by the way, it's really, I buy really good mill flour. I mean, I think it's really important to get the good stuff if you're going to bake at home, because it's not much more expensive, and you know, I think it makes a big difference.
Yeah. Eggs, you know, eggs come in different sizes, and you often see that recipes call for a certain size egg, you know, large egg, let's say. But there are even large eggs from one farm might be different than the large eggs from another farm. How do you cook accurately when it comes to eggs?
Well, yeah, you don't want to switch extra large for medium or whatever. That is a big difference. You can go back to what I just said, which is weigh your ingredients. An egg's about 2 ounces or so. So you can just weigh them, and that's the way to get around it. Now, it depends on the recipe. If you're making a cake and you're creaming, you're beating eggs with sugar, you know, probably doesn't make too much difference. But there are recipes where it would make a lot of difference. So I would weigh it, 2 ounces per egg.
You've brought a couple of recipes to share with us today, and they'll be linked on our episode note after the show's over. But they look lovely. First is a tomato olive focaccia. Which country inspired that bread?
Focaccia is Italian. It's a very high liquid bread. That is, if you weigh the flour and you weigh the water and divide the weight of the water by the weight of the flour, that's your hydration percentage, which simply means, you know, what percent of the bread is liquid. A lot of breads are 55 to 65% hydration. Focaccia gets up to 85 to 90%. And that's why you get the big holes, like in a pizza dough or in a focaccia. That's why you get that, because there's a lot of water in the dough. So focaccia is not hard to make. It's just a high hydration bread dough baked in a sheet pan. And so you can actually, I did a pizza dough where you don't have to stretch it out. You just let it rise. It's essentially focaccia dough. And it's very liquid. I mean, those doughs, focaccias, are hard to handle. They're really not, you don't really handle them by kneading them by hand. They're so liquidy. So you can make pizza that way as well. And you get a great pizza, but you don't have to actually stretch it. You pour it into the pan, and it's pour in the pan pizza. So it's the same thing as focaccia.
And that was, yeah, and that pizza was really intriguing to me, because you start with the, you know, what would be the toppings, and then you pour the crust, you pour the dough on over the top of the ingredients, you know, whatever it is you're using for toppings.
Yeah, you do a lot of upside down pizzas that way. You can cook them in a skillet, and it's sort of like doing, you know, tart tatin or something like that. It's the ingredients are at the bottom.
Grant emailed us, an avid bread baker, 5 years ago or so. They came up with a very unique yeasted sweet corn bread. Uses super fresh corn that's cut from the cob and pureed. and the puree creates all the liquid in the dough.
Huh.
Much to Grant's surprise, it was included in the Dane County Farmers Market 50th year cookbook. Grant makes variations of it using pureed asparagus or pureed roasted tomatoes in place of the sweet corn.
Yeah, that's I like that idea, and I love using the milk from the corn, not the kernels. You can use a milker, or you can just take a knife and slice through and then take the back of the knife and get all that wonderful liquid out. And that's great for making corn puddings or corn soufflés or cornbread. I'm not a big fan of kernels of corn in my bread. That completely freaks me out. I completely lose my mind. But I love the idea of using the liquid from the corn because it has a tremendous amount of flavor. So it sounds like a good idea.
Carol in Wanakee has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I have been a baker forever. In fact, it took me 6 tries to find the perfect cinnamon roll recipe. But a question that I have, because I've started to ask myself why I put the shelf in at the level that I do in the oven. Sometimes I have it right in the middle and sometimes the one above or the one below. And I understand it's going to have to do higher in the oven is going to be warmer, but are there other considerations?
Yeah, it's not really about that. It's about the top and bottom of what you're baking. For example, if you're baking a pie, you want it probably on the lowest rack because you want the bottom of that crust to bake up well. So if you have a glass pie dish, Pyrex pie dish, I would put it on the bottom rack because you really want to get that bottom crust cooked through. If you have something you're baking where you really want the top to get really well browned, you would put it on a higher rack. In general, you probably, like a cake or something, probably, because most ovens, the racks are not exactly in the middle, sort of on the rack that's at the bottom third. So the top of the cake's in the top third, something like that. That would be my go-to. But pies in particular do really well on the bottom racks. So,
Carol, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And Sally emailed us. She was happy to hear you speak to the accolades of using lard for pie crust. Sally's grandmother always used lard.
Yeah.
She shared her recipe with Sally, used it for years, and when they had access to an apple orchard and would make multiple pies for the freezer, crust was always perfect. She got out of the habit of using lard and struggled with good pie crust ever since, so she thinks she is now going back to the lard recipe.
Yeah, it's got to be leaf lard, though, because if you go to the supermarket and buy lard, it's going to taste porky. So you want to use leaf lard. Leaf lard, is, as I said earlier, is the fat around the kidney. It doesn't have a bacony or porky flavor. It has a very neutral flavor. So that's what old-time bakers used to use. And boy, there was a place in Vermont I went to years ago, and they made all their pies there with leaf lard. And flaky and light, and it doesn't sound like it should work, but it's really, really, really good.
Well, can you go and buy, leaf lard somewhere? Or
I don't think you can buy in a supermarket. I think if you have a co-op, I shop at a co-op in Vermont where you could probably get it. You probably have to order it. But it keeps nicely, and I have 4 big bottles of it in my fridge for my daughter. And so I'm all stocked now, but if you want to make the world's best pie crust, that's what you need to use.
John wonders, how can you tell that the dough is done rising?
It's pretty easy. You put your finger in it, and it should actually, I believe what should happen is the indentation should remain. The problem with rising, there are 2 problems. Everybody's kitchen's at a different temperature. So if you're trying to proof dough at 65 degrees, it really should be proof more like at 80 degrees. So it'll take a long time. The second thing that's a problem is people proof in a bowl, and it's hard to look to see if it's doubled. It's the geometry is a bit confusing. So you can get straight-sided plastic containers. King Arthur sells them, and they have markings. So, or you can mark it yourself. So one way around this is with a bowl, is to fill it with the amount of water that represents the volume of the dough you're going to put in, and then put in that same amount of water again and mark it on the bowl. Take a marker on the outside or a piece of tape. So even if it's if it's round size sides, you'll know when you've doubled the dough. And the last thing I'd say is I bought a proofing box a couple of years ago. Actually, we sell them, but they're a little expensive. They're plastic. They fold up. And you just put the bowl on a rack in this box, this plastic box. You plug it in, and you can set the temperature for whatever you want. It's a godsend because everything proofs in exactly the right amount of time. You know, I woke up one morning in Vermont in my house, and the kitchen was 52 degrees. So, like, you're not going to be proofing dough in a 55-degree kitchen. So if you make a lot of bread, I strongly recommend getting some kind of proofing box. You can turn your oven into a proofing box. That's a little tricky. You heat it up for 10 minutes on low and then turn it off. But a proofing box, or you can get these little pads you put the bowl on and they heat up. That also works pretty well. But temperature is really important.
Chris Kimball is our guest today. His latest book is titled Milk Street Bakes, a lovely book. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking baking today with Chris Kimball. Christopher Kimball's latest book is Milk Street Bakes. So questions for him about baking or maybe about the book, I hope you'll give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address talk@WPR.org. I mentioned that you had supplied us with a couple of recipes from the book. There was a cake, a chocolate cake, and it's made on the stovetop.
Yeah, this is, if you don't have an oven, this is a great cake. It's a cake, it's steamed, and you put it on a rack in, let's say, a Dutch oven or other big pot, and you essentially steam it in a cake pan. I believe it uses cocoa and not chocolate. And you get this incredible, light, velvety texture. And the chocolate is present, but it's not too, you know, problem with a lot of chocolate cakes, I know this sounds odd, they're too chocolatey, but it has a nice chocolate flavor, but it's not overpowering. So you put it in a regular cake pan, there's some water, there's a rack, put the top on, steam it. And it's absolutely, it's one of my favorite chocolate cakes. It's just really delicious.
And looks delicious in the book. By the way, the photography in your book is really good. It is really, really good.
And yeah, I think this, I really like the photos in this book. I mean, they're really, they're not fancy, but they're just really appealing.
Yeah, they are very appealing. And to me, a cookbook should have photos. I like to see sort of the final product or what it should look like.
Well, it's a good thing you weren't alive in the 1890s because Fanny Farmer didn't have a lot of pictures. She had a few black and whites, but that's about it.
Yeah. Oh man. So the cooking process, pretty simple for that.
Yeah. A lot of cakes, you know, when I grew up, you know, I did a lot of one bowl cakes, right? I just did one today, which was a sticky chocolate cake from Sweden. Again, one bowl cake, really easy to make. You know, I think that's, I mean, no one does cakes better than Americans. I mean, I think our layer cakes are brilliant. Like a Southern coconut cake with four layers, you just die and go to heaven. It's just one of the great cakes. But the rest of the world, Europe, tends to do torts or one layer cakes, and they're much easier to do, and some of them are great.
You know, you often see espresso powder alongside cocoa powder in recipes like this cake, and also in brownies. How do these flavors complement each other?
Oh, I don't think you have a hard time with espresso or chocolate powder in chocolate. You know, coffee and chocolate obviously goes really well together. I think it's when you start adding some other things. First of all, salt. You know, a lot of all recipes don't call for salt in desserts, especially cakes. You absolutely need salt. That's really important. I think some bakers I know put in all sorts of herbs like rosemary in, or they put other stuff. And I sometimes that works and sometimes that doesn't. It depends on the mix. But salt's important. Espresso or coffee powder really helps out a lot. Molasses goes really well. And I think that, and I'll go back to something I said earlier, having something that's not bitter, but something that offsets sweetness, I think is a really nice idea. Because if I were to say anything about English desserts, where a lot of our cooking came from, at least at one time, it was sweet on sweet, right? It was just a lot of sugar. So I think, as I said, using a little rye flour in place of some of the all-purpose, it just adds that extra dimension. I think that's what makes a great dessert.
Kathy in Madison has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Kathy.
Hello. Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is about using butter or oil in cake recipes. And I have some recipes I like, and it's one is all butter, but the cake ends up too dense, and I was hoping to be able to substitute with it some oil, but I don't see if that would make it a little bit less dense. But I don't think the amounts are equal because butter has liquid in it. And I was just hoping for a little more information.
Well, I'd have to ask you a question. The butter you use, is the butter getting creamed in the recipe with sugar or just being added melted, or how's the butter treated?
It's usually creamed with the sugar.
Yeah, well, that substitution is not going to work because the butter, when it's creamed, air is whipped into it and it becomes light, as you know, and that helps aerate and create the light texture of the cake. If you just use vegetable oil, obviously that's not going to, incorporate air, and you'll get a denser cake. The one reason, though, in place you can use oil in cakes is like a carrot cake, right? Or an olive oil cake or whatever. What happens is butter tends to give you a drier texture. Oil, it gives you a very moist texture. And the cake, like a carrot cake, will last longer. 3 days later, you still have a moist slice of cake versus butter. So, another one is chiffon cake uses some oil. So I love oil in cakes. I think it's great. But if you're creaming butter and sugar, you can't substitute oil. That's just going to change the texture.
Yeah. Kathy, there you go. Thank you. Another Kathy, this one in Middleton. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. How you doing, Larry?
Good. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Well, I have changed my lifestyle dramatically, and I want to keep it that way. I am cooking more for one and two. I no longer have dinner parties. I don't want to. I don't want to have this fuss, this muss, this measuring, this mixing, this chopping, this pureeing, all of these small garbage appliances that the TV shows tell you got to have or you're not going to have a decent life. So what I use primarily is an Emeril oven that I bought a few years ago. I can't say I'm really happy with it, but I'm not necessarily unhappy with it. How do I use it to the best of its ability?
So it's like a toaster oven, you're saying?
Well, it's supposed to do everything under the sun except to, slice bread.
an Emeril toast oven is what you're talking about. Okay.
Yeah, the stovetop ovens, depending on how big they are, yeah, some of them can do a chicken pretty well. You can bake in it, do a lot of stuff. There's nothing wrong with that. You're not going to do huge batches of things, but a loaf cake, for example, a pound cake, you can do a lot of stuff. You can do small batches of cookies. Yeah, they're and a lot of people now make, Breville makes them, a lot of people make them. You certainly can do that. I mean, I'm going to push back a little bit on you because you want to cut back on the mess and everything else. I think it's how you cook, I remember in the 70s I'd have a dinner party on Saturday and I cook all Friday night and I get up early Saturday and, I bake. It was just a mess. 15 hours of baking and this and that. I just don't do that anymore. Like if I have people over occasionally, I'll make two things. I'll make a pot of soup or stew, you know, main thing, throw together a salad, which takes 2 minutes, and then I'll make some simple dessert. I actually had a friend of mine over who's a chef in Boston, and we did hot dogs and hamburgers, you know, and I made some homemade ice cream, but that was about it. So I just think if you don't want the mess and the fuss, and I totally understand you, just create a menu that's like one thing, like make a bowl of soup and buy some bread and you're done, and a glass of wine. You know, I don't think people are going to be happier with the more things they get. Just give them one thing and you know, make a salad and get a glass of wine and have a loaf of bread and, you know, and then it's done. You could do it the day before. So it might be just how you manage your menu that might make it easier for you. But anyway, the stovetop ovens do work.
Kathy, thank you for calling. And Joseph emailed us. He would like to bake fresh bread for his wife who doesn't eat gluten, but he really struggles with gluten-free conversions. Any suggestions?
Well, yeah, there are, you know, there are a few companies that make a one-for-one gluten-free flour. They use rice flour and, you know, corn flour and everything else, cornstarch and et cetera. If you're making bread, an American loaf or a rustic, you know, European loaf, those are the hardest things to do gluten-free. You're just not going to get the texture. My strong suggestion is get a cookbook that's specifically designed for gluten-free bread baking, because one size does not fit all. I've done this many times. I did a gluten-free book 15 years ago, and it turned out that every recipe was a little different, especially when it comes to breads. Like, for example, you're doing a bread baked in a loaf pan. One of the problems was it would rise up just over the sides of the pan into the oven. So there are all sorts of problems. So I think for a cookie, you know, you can get away with it with a one-for-one gluten-free flour substitution. But bread, because it's so dependent on gluten, you know, is something you'd have to go buy a book that's really focused on that.
Yeah, it makes sense. You mentioned pans, and sometimes it just bothers me. You know, you're baking something, and it'll say a 9x5 pan, and I've got a 9x13 pan.
Right.
Drives me nuts. You do address that in your book.
The first thing you want to do is figure out the, you know, multiply the length by the width and figure out where you are. The problem is it's going to completely change the baking. If you have an 8-inch cake pan versus a 9-inch cake pan, it's going to change the baking times. And you may have to actually lower your oven a little bit for the 8-inch pan to make sure the center gets cooked properly. So messing around with sizes can be a little dicey. You know, pizza is not a problem, but any cake, the cake pan is going to make a big difference. As I said, dark pan versus light pan is also a really big change.
Yeah, it is indeed. What's your favorite baked good to eat?
Well, it really is apple pie, because in the old days, people used 3 or 4 different varieties of apples. And in the old days, apples actually had flavor. I find a lot of the new varieties are super sweet. But, you know, they like sheep's nose and all these other things, pippin, and they had not a savory flavor, but they had a really interesting flavor to them. And so making apple pie with different apples that has a great crust, when you get that right, this is the time of year where you can go find some of those apples. It is an extraordinary dish, but it's not just a bunch of, it's not sweet on sweet. It has more complexity to it. So I think if I was going to hire someone as a baker, that would be the test. Like, can you make a good apple pie? Because it's not easy.
And on that note, Chris, I want to thank you so much for taking an hour to be with us today to talk about baking and to talk about your wonderful book. It's a beauty. Milk Street Bakes is the title. And, Chris, I hope we can do it again. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Have a good Thanksgiving.
You as well. Well, and I want to thank you for joining us today. You know, all of our shows are kind of a team effort. Our producers are Clara Kniper, Joe Patnod. Our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I am Larry Mealer, and I thank you so much. It was a fun show today. A couple of great segments and topics with some great people who know what they are doing. And you know what? I bet right through the afternoon that you'll be hearing from a lot of people who know what they're doing, and I stay with us. I'm Larry Mealer for WPR News.